Mesdames, messieurs, bonjour. Vous savez que j'ai la bougeotte et que j'aime parler debout. Je vais quand même rejoindre notre invité lors de notre conversation, mais je profite de ce moment de liberté pour introduire le sujet avant de passer, ainsi que je le disais, à notre conversation sur le thème d'histoire et de fiction. Dans le contexte, en profitant de la parution en français des Nuits de la peste, le dernier roman d'Orhan Pamuk, que je remercie de nous avoir rejoints ici. Ceci fait partie de mon cours, puisque je profite du recoupement, de la coïncidence, disons, entre le sujet de ce roman et le thème de mon cours cette année, la période hamidienne, l'autocratie hamidienne. Et par conséquent, c'est ainsi que j'ai inscrit cette séance dans la liste des séminaires que j'avais promis. C'est la dernière, puisque ma chaire se termine cette année. Je pense que l'expression consacrée de la papauté permet exactement de rendre le sentiment que j'ai en ce moment. Sic transit gloria mundis, c'est comme ça, mais que voulez-vous ? Je passe au sujet de notre séminaire. Histoire et fonction, et fiction, avec Orhan Pamuk, je vous donne en couverture, en ouverture, les couvertures de la version turque parue l'année dernière et française parue en mars chez Gallimard de l'ouvrage que nous allons discuter. Et pour cela, je me permets de faire quelques observations concernant la manière dont j'ai moi-même pris ce livre, mes propres observations sur le rapport parfois ambigu entre l'histoire et la fiction, après quoi je passerai à la table pour discuter en détail de cet ouvrage et du sujet avec Orhan Pamuk. Les croisements entre l'histoire et d'autres disciplines sont nombreux. Si l'on définit l'histoire comme une catégorie générale d'analyse et de récit, on pourra dénombrer bien des disciplines hybrides qui en découlent. L'histoire politique, l'histoire culturelle, l'histoire de l'art, l'histoire des mentalités, l'histoire de la littérature, l'histoire sociale, l'histoire économique, l'histoire intellectuelle, l'histoire urbaine, j'en passe, et des meilleurs. Chacune de ces disciplines demande un degré de spécialisation et d'expérience en dehors de l'histoire. À titre d'exemple, il me paraît évident que l'histoire économique, la bonne histoire économique ou démographique, exige la maîtrise de connaissances qui dépassent de beaucoup celles de l'historien moyen. Ce qui nous réunit ici est un croisement dans le sens inverse, où l'histoire ne constitue pas le fondement, mais plutôt le cadre d'une activité intellectuelle. Je veux parler du roman historique. Or, je pense que dans ce cas particulier, la balance penche tout particulièrement en faveur des talents et des connaissances extérieures à l'histoire. Le romancier ou la romancière possède sur l'historien ou l'historienne. Pour éviter toute lourdeur, je vous prie de considérer que désormais toute occurrence de ces termes tiendra compte des deux genres. Historien, historienne, non. L'avantage d'une liberté presque totale sur le récit. Certes, on pourra toujours reprocher aux romanciers d'avoir commis des erreurs concernant les dates, les lieux ou les identités de tel événement ou de tel personnage ayant réellement existé ou eu lieu. Nous ne devons cependant pas oublier que ces données factuelles ne constituent qu'un aspect fort superficiel et secondaire de l'histoire. J'ai toujours dit que si l'on pensait pouvoir donner une réponse précise et définitive à une question en histoire, c'était que celle-ci était probablement sans véritable intérêt, pour ne pas dire bête. La véritable tâche de l'auteur de romans historiques est d'échafauder le récit qu'il ou elle a l'intention de raconter. En cela, il ou elle, désormais il, puisqu'après tout nous parlons d'Orhan Pamuk, est entièrement libre. Non sans ironie, cela me paraît correspondre assez précisément à ce que l'historien ne peut jamais réaliser. En effet, c'est là que se situe la plus grande difficulté pour lui. Une fois sa collecte de documents et de données achevée, l'historien, en particulier l'historien un peu traditionnel, disons, se trouve confronté au défi de ce qu'il n'a pas pu documenter et ce dont la documentation est discutable, incomplète. Des pensées, des sentiments, des décisions, des événements pour lesquels il n'existe guère de véritable documentation. En d'autres termes, la vie, avec toute sa complexité. Évidemment, il tentera de combler ses lacunes en fouillant dans des mémoires, des registres de tribunaux, dans la presse quotidienne, dans des journaux intimes, dans des témoignages contemporains, mais il le fera avec précaution, avec prudence, voire avec méfiance, puisqu'il sait bien que toutes ces sources sont sujettes à des risques d'erreurs découlant d'exagérations, de distorsions partisanes, d'intérêts personnels ou tout simplement d'ignorance. Pour s'en prévenir, l'historien les prendra avec des pincettes, pesant le pour et le contre, séparant le bon du mauvais, le probable de l'impossible, la connaissance de la simple supposition. L'auteur de romans historiques, lui, est libre. Il pourra attribuer à ses personnages, de sa création ou non, les pensées et les sentiments qu'il voudra et combler ainsi toutes les lacunes qui viennent grever le travail de l'historien. On ne lui demandera que de s'assurer de ce que les événements, les lieux, les personnages, les détails de son récit soient assez proches de la réalité pour convaincre ses lecteurs d'une certaine cohérence. Un mot décrit au mieux cette attente, la vraisemblance. C'est là un très beau mot. Dans vraisemblable, il y a vrai et il y a semblable, soit une combinaison qui résume le fond même de la recherche historique. La recherche du probable, c'est-à-dire ce qui a l'apparence du vrai, et du plausible, qui mérite d'être applaudi littéralement pour sa justesse. En effet, il ne faut pas se faire d'illusions. L'histoire n'est pas la recherche du vrai, dont on a depuis longtemps accepté la nature fugace et relative, mais bien du probable que l'on espère atteindre par le biais de la rigueur méthodologique et d'une analyse critique. Nous savons à quel point notre perception de l'histoire est faussée par notre désir d'y insérer une causalité qui expliquerait le pourquoi et le comment des événements. Or, nous le savons bien, pour chaque effet supposé, il existe un nombre infini de causes possibles. De causes dont nous finissons par choisir celles qui nous paraissent logiques, probables, vraisemblables, parfois même utiles, au détriment de celles qui nous paraissent invraisemblables ou que nous n'arrivons même pas à identifier ou à imaginer. En fait, nous risquons à tout moment de rédiger l'histoire comme si nous racontions un film dont nous aurions vu la fin. La téléologie nous guette à tous les coins et recoins du passé. D'un certain point de vue, l'auteur du roman historique fait sciemment ce que l'historien tente à faire intuitivement. Le récit et sa fin lui appartiennent, il le bâtit comme il l'entend, lui donne l'orientation qu'il choisit, j'irais même jusqu'à dire qu'il écrit l'histoire, véritablement, puisqu'elle sort tout entière de son imagination et de sa plume. Il peut évidemment choisir l'équilibre qu'il voudra maintenir entre histoire et fiction. Certains préféreront un contexte historique bien défini, voire contraignant, ne laissant qu'une faible marge aux personnages et événements fictifs. D'autres choisiront au contraire d'inverser ce rapport et de donner pleine liberté à leur fiction dans un cadre historique extrêmement souple. C'est dans cette catégorie que s'inscrivent les Nuits de la peste. Cette stratégie ouvre la porte à beaucoup de créativité. Le choix du Nil, qui plus est une île imaginaire, offre bien des libertés à l'imagination de l'auteur. Dois-je vous rappeler à quel point les îles tiennent une place importante dans la fiction? D'Ithaque à l'Utopia de Moore, de Robinson Crusoe à l'île au trésor, les îles ont de tout temps occupé une place de choix dans l'imaginaire humain. Je me souviens encore de la curiosité et de l'émotion avec lesquelles j'ai découvert, il y a de cela des lustres, l'île mystérieuse de Jules Verne et examiné dans ses moindres détails la si convaincante carte qui y figurait. Toutefois, le contexte insulaire revêt un sens tout particulier lorsqu'il s'agit de l'histoire ottomane, les îles ayant toujours été marquées par une fascinante ambiguïté. Dès ses premiers temps, l'Empire s'était rendu maître de bon nombre d'îles, mais la domination ottomane y était toujours restée superficielle, douteuse. N'oublions pas qu'au-delà d'une courte période faste, l'Empire ottoman n'a guère exercé de contrôle direct et efficace sur les mers. Les 25 années qu'il fallut aux Ottomans au milieu du XVIIe siècle pour prendre la Crète est un signe précurseur d'une faiblesse qui s'instaura dans les siècles suivants. Au XIXe siècle, alors que les grandes puissances bâtissaient leurs empires coloniaux sur leur puissance maritime, les Ottomans étaient à peine capables de conserver les quelques îles qui leur restaient. Dès les années 1820, bien des îles de l'archipel, les îles de l'Égée, avaient rejoint la rébellion grecque et acquis leur indépendance. En 1878, Abdulhamid avait offert Chypre aux Britanniques en échange de leur soutien diplomatique. Depuis les années 1840, la Crète fut la proie de conflits sanglants qui aboutirent sur son annexion par la Grèce. D'ailleurs, Minger, l'île d'Orhanpamuk, n'est pas sans rappeler la Crète. Population musulmane importante, distance à la fois de l'Anatolie et de la Grèce, trace d'une ancienne et mystérieuse civilisation, un isolement presque autarcique, voire un blocus par les cuirassés des grandes puissances. Minger est une sorte de microcosme ottoman. On y trouve tous les espoirs, toutes les inquiétudes, toutes les nouveautés, toutes les traditions, toutes les peurs, toutes les tensions qui sous-tendent cette période. Il n'y manque rien. Une préfecture, des couvents de derviches, des consuls, des brigands, des paysans, des gendarmes, des entrepreneurs, un hôpital, un bureau de poste, une prison, un site archéologique, des commerçants, une mairie. On y découvre ainsi tout ce qui régit la vie dans cette périphérie ottomane au tournant du XXe siècle. Santé, épidémie, politique, autocratie, administration, corruption, espionnage, délation, nationalisme, archéologie, relations intercommunautaires, communication, transport, violence, impérialisme. Quant à la vraisemblance, il me semble bien que les nuits de la peste n'auront aucun mal à convaincre le lecteur de ce que l'auteur sait de quoi il parle. Il suffit pour cela de se prêter à l'exercice fort amusant d'illustrer certaines scènes ou personnages du roman avec des images tirées d'une réalité historique. Je viens de le faire avec cette photographie de cuirassés européens saluant au canon pendant le blocus de la Crète en 1897. Image que l'on pourrait facilement transposer dans le récit de Minger, la pestiférée. Je pourrais aussi prétendre avoir trouvé dans le célèbre album des costumes populaires ottomans de Hamdi Bey et Marie Delaunay, publié en 1873, les portraits de certains des protagonistes du roman. Il me paraît toutefois essentiel de rappeler que les nuits de la peste ne se limitent pas au simple cadre de l'histoire ottomane. Comment ignorer, en effet, que le récit qui est fait de l'indépendance de l'île fait écho à un phénomène qui se propage avec plus ou moins de bonheur d'un continent à l'autre et qui annonce déjà les transformations qui s'empareront du globe pendant le XXe siècle. Comment ne pas voir que le major puis commandant Kamil, en qui le nombrilisme turc a voulu voir une évocation de Mustafa Kemal Pacha, le futur Atatürk, correspond en fait au personnage bien plus universel du révolutionnaire et du libérateur dont on connaît tant d'exemples souvent tragiques. Permettez-moi de terminer en remarquant à quel point ce roman, au-delà d'être historique, fait la part belle à l'histoire en tant que discipline. Les exemples abondent. La maîtresse de Sami Pacha, grecque, enseigne l'histoire au lycée grec de Lille. La révolution mingérienne elle-même se fait en grande partie à coup de réécriture et de censure de l'histoire. Mais c'est toutefois dans la préface que c'est la préface qui nous réserve la véritable surprise. L'auteur du récit, Mina Mingerli, se révèle être à la fois l'arrière-petite-fille de la sultane Parakizeh et de son mari Nuri Pacha, et une historienne. Or, sa vision de ce récit rappelle étrangement mes propos en introduction. Ceci, dit-elle, est à la fois un roman historique et une histoire romancée. Elle s'en explique un peu plus tard. Lorsque j'effectuais des recherches sur les événements survenus sur l'île lors de l'épidémie de peste de 1901, sentant que la science historique ne suffirait pas à saisir les décisions subjectives prises par les héros pendant cet épisode aussi court que dramatique, et que l'art du roman aiderait plus à les comprendre, j'ai essayé de réunir les deux. Sur ces paroles pleines de sagesse, je me tourne vers Orhan Pamuk afin d'entamer une conversation sur ces nuits de la peste et sur sa perception du rapport entre histoire et fiction. Je vous remercie. Vous savez, je crois que ça a été annoncé, je l'ai annoncé la dernière fois, notre entretien sera en anglais. Par conséquent, vous avez, je pense, eu l'occasion de vous munir de casques, des casques qui étaient offerts à l'entrée, pour suivre l'interprétation simultanée, la traduction simultanée de notre conversation. Si qui que ce soit a besoin de se munir d'un casque, nous pouvons attendre quelques minutes, le temps de... Mais apparemment... Bon. Donc il suffit de vous munir d'un casque. À la fin, si nous avons des questions dans la salle, la traduction sera assurée du français vers l'anglais aussi. Donc nous avons une traduction qui va dans les deux sens. Donc je commence donc en anglais, vous le disais-je, cette conversation, je commencerai... I will start first by thanking Orhan Pamuk for coming here. We had already had the pleasure of his participation in a seminar, in a workshop in October last year. Unfortunately, it was via Zoom because he at the time was stuck in Columbia, at Columbia in New York. This time, we have him en chair et en os, we have him in the flesh, which is a great pleasure. So all my thanks to his participation in this.
It's a great pleasure to be here. We're going to enjoy this.
So I've prepared a number of questions, but obviously I won't have to stick exactly to the questions I've written. We may engage in a conversation, and as far as I know, Orhan Pamuk, he may improvise and bring up totally new issues, which is one of the most rewarding ways in which a conversation can be held on such a rich subject as fiction and history. But I will start with a kind of predictable question, that of his interest in historical novels, because The Nights of the Plague, Les Nuits de la Peste, is not his first historical novel. I mean, he's written The White Castle, he's written My Name is Red, which are historical novels that are located in what is called the classical age of the Ottoman Empire. Snow can be considered as a historical novel in the very recent past of the Turkish Republic. His first novel was a historical novel, a historical saga of a family, Cevdet Bey and his sons. So it seems very clear that he has something history. So my question would be, do you consider to be yourself, first and foremost, a historical novelist? And do you have a penchant for telling stories and creating plots that are carefully lodged in a past that you consider to be relevant to yourself and to your readership?
Okay, I sometimes tell to my friends that I publish 11 novels, of which 3.5 are historical, meaning, for example, Black Book is partly historical. There are historical scenes in the novel, but they are written by a columnist, so forth and so on. But the reasons or the mood or the form or the way I take history in each of these novels are different. That in my early novel, for example, I don't consider Cevdet Bey that the historical aspect of Cevdet Bey is that important. It is also a story of my family. My grandfather, especially the midsection, is copied, I would say, in a rough way, from my family stories that I've heard, that I partly lived, the traditions of, say, religious holiday, enjoying alcohol during the religious holiday, kind of paradoxes of Muslim bourgeoisie, things that I liked writing about even in my early years. For example, Cevdet was more autobiographical, familiar novel. White Castle, which is entirely historical, cared less about representing history as I did in Knights of Plague in a Tolstoyan way, while White Castle was more, I would say, influenced more from Italo Calvino, a sort of a Calvinesque history, a subject that I also want to talk about. Historical novel has changed so much, let's say, from its invention in early 19th century to today. So, in fact, my name is Red, yes, it's a historical novel, but my main aim, my main motivation, the desire to write did not start from representing the 590s of Ottoman Empire. I did not care much about that. But I wanted to write about painting, seeing the world through images in a country, in a culture where figurative painting is forbidden. How do people react to it? And if there is not a strong tradition of painting in a culture, how do we form pictures in our minds, so forth and so on. And I think, because I agree, I argue that thinking is also, we think not only with words, but we also think with images. But if there is not a strong tradition of painting, what happens? How is that related to? So My Name is Red, which is entirely a historical novel, my motivation was not to represent like an historian the period, but in fact express myself, my desire to paint and combine it with bigger ideas. While I am more a historian in the sense of that Tolstoy was a historian in this novel, Knights of Plague, because I wanted to represent, give a Tolstoyan picture, while my methods, my chapters, the way I see things are different, more modern, postmodern, more creative, not 19th century realism. Here I was, my motivations were more the motivations of a historian. Perhaps that's why we have Mina Mingerli as a sort of a filtering voice and perhaps trying to relate to the ideological problems, scholarly problems of being a historian, partly because in the last 10 years, I am 14 years, I'm also a professor at Columbia University, and I know a bit academic world. Mina Mingerli is invented by me to filter my story through the eyes of, and with irony, of the academic world. But yes, I am a historical novelist in that sense, but not as a classical historical novelist, say Walter Scott, and the greatest historical novelist, by the way, is Tolstoy, War and Peace. We tend to forget it because so many years had passed by the day he wrote it. was a historical novel, or Alessandro Manzoni's Italian Betrothed was a sort of an also influence to this novel, was a historical novel in the sense that these writers, just like me, sat down in their homes, bought a lot of books, read those books, researched sometimes sources as Manzoni did, and wrote their historical novel. And the process of writing a novel is so complex that you don't write a novel with only one single motivation. Yes, you write just like an historian, accurately to represent an epoch, an age, whatever. Also, a novel is art, and you want to self-express yourself, put in a problematical shape my problems that I see. Even my most, quote, objective novel, perhaps Cevdet Bey, my early novel, as also novels are also waves of self-expression. In fact, I argue that writing a novel is balancing between self-representation, self-expression, and the representation of history, or sometimes it's not history, it's journalism. So my take is, yes, I am, one-third historical novelist. I am aware of that.
Mm-hmm. That's obviously, it's not an accusation. So obviously, we're fine.
I am
with
defensive.
That.
I'm sorry.
I think your public enjoys very much that aspect of your production. You mentioned, and I ended mentioning Mina Mingerli, and you said that you used her as an access into the world of academe, which is true, but at the same time, you use her to show what the limitations are of the world of academic history, and you make her use the historical novel as a way to break the shackles, say, of traditional history.
Yes, first, there is, we should say this, there is a distinction between history and fiction. Though, yes, we are all aware of the fact that there is a lot of fiction in history, and as in the historical novel, there is a lot of history in fiction too. But on the other hand, I would not say, although I have some postmodernist past, I would not say that there's no difference. It's all stories. No, there is a difference. That, you know, Umberto Eco once said, everyone was talking, you can interpret every way, everything in the way you want. There is a limit to interpretation, and there is a limit to saying that history is also fiction like fiction. No, history wants to represent reality accurately without invention of fiction. Though we may say that historians claim that they objectively represent history, and we may say, as a scholar or as a philosopher, well, actually, sir, that's not true. All you are influenced by ideologies, by the official representation of the past. You are entrapped by the documents or whatever is written about them, and you are also limited, and you fill the gaps with your fiction, which is partly true. But even when the historian fills the gaps between documents, memories, whatever is documented in history, even if he or she is filling them with his or her imagination, that filling part is entirely filling realistically, filling, and probably it might have happened this way, is the discourse of the historian, while the discourse of the fiction writer is not, it might have been happened this way. I am asserting that the personality of this person or this detail, I'm inventing that is this way. I am not saying it might have happened this way. I am saying I have the freedom of inventing this and asserting this. And in fact, historical novelists, if he knows that the reader will come to him, not because of what it would have been like this, but I inject into the real history my imagination, and that's why you come and read me. Tolstoy reads all the details of Napoleonic wars in Russia, Napoleon's war in Russia. He is very occult. He's a hardworking writer. But then we have Pierre there, the main hero, who is not real. He may be a composite of various memoirs of various aristocrats, but Pierre Tolstoy is saying, okay, here we have Napoleon, and I am trying to get him accurately right, like an historian. But I'm also introducing and paving way and opening an immense new world in which there is a fictional character, which I'm saying I invented him. You want to read this novel, not because I got Napoleon right, but I got Pierre right into this reality. So this is the difference. There is a line that I cannot say like a cynical postmodernist, oh, it's all fiction, they're all inventing things, what's the difference, it's all ideology. I'm not saying that.
I agree, but I cannot help but notice that you seem to have a higher opinion of history than I have.
And of the
capacity of historians to get it right.
Yes, perhaps because I'm coming from a family of engineers, maybe I have a higher opinion of reality than you have, although I'm a fiction writer.
No, but of course I agree with you, but I think that to the historian, it is a very sobering, very interesting exercise to think of the lacunae in our historical narrative and the way in which the historical novelist has a possibility to write history. I mean, that's what I said, and it's your freedom. And obviously, it is total invention, but it's not completely unshackled invention. It is an invention within a framework, and you end up doing what most historians do, go for something that is, I insist on vraisemblable in French, verisimilitude.
Well, okay.
You're going for the plausible.
Then I'll tell you this.
Okay.
Not in White Castle, which is, as I said, a Calvinesque story.
Yes.
Calvino wrote three novels, sometimes they're published together with the title in English, Our Ancestors, The Cloven Viscount. I forgot the title of the other two now, but they are not imitating reality. A Viscount is cut by a sword into two, and the other half is walking around and talking and narrating the story. Now, he is not aiming at getting, he is not setting his story in the plane of realism. He is, at the first page, refusing the traditional realistic methods of the classical historical novel, though his novel is also attractive in a historical way. I'll ask myself, if I read Calvino's novels, The Cloven Viscount, all summed up, put together in, what side of, what aspect of these Calvino novels are historical? I think now we are approaching the way I look at history. Well, history motivates his romantic or his playful imagination. We writers are not, or I am also, even in this Knights of Plague, I am not after representing history right, though I want to do it. But more interesting thing is history motivates, gives fuel to, makes fires in my romantic imagination. I was interested in White Castle in history, not to explain the history, not to say, hey, look, in old times, the plague was the same, you know, and more or less the same things. I did not care about that, though, by the side, I have also, one part of my mind is also busy with getting this kind of little fruits, but the main body of my thinking is that I want to surround myself with old things. Hermann Hesse, you know, the romantic German writer once said, you know, I don't know, I'm unhappy with modern life and I want to surround myself with old things, he said. I think the clearest way of approach the fiction, historical fiction by most writers is very plainly expressed by Hermann Hesse. He wrote this in an essay, saying that he is not there to decipher, to write about, to put in a totality some historical period to represent decline or glory or this period of Ottoman or whatever empire, but he is more busy with history in a poetical way so that he will find some authenticity, something that he would be happy to surround himself into, to play around with. That is also why I am motivated by history. That is the beginnings of, for me, to imagine a 600-page plague book. My starting point is not in that sense positivistic and realistic. Let me write something about plague and they all encyclopedically learn about it. Perhaps I have that too by the side in the novel. Mm-hmm. But the first thing is to be surrounded by some images, to live also romantically, live in that age. When I venture into a novel, which most of the time takes 3 years, 4 years, I'm also venturing into a sort of world of images. I wanted to live in history. Mm. I wanted to live in a particular time in history, to be surrounded by play, etc.
Isn't your Museum of Innocence, both the novel and the museum itself, mm-hmm. the embodiment of this romantic desire to be surrounded by old things, which to me is extremely interesting because the Museum of Innocence is both a glorification of history and of museum and mocking. It's a caricature of history and museums for their very naive belief in the fact that you can document time.
The mocking part, the ironical part, is not that important. It is important at the beginning. You say, oh, there's a museum in a fictional story. People smile, and perhaps some of them are visiting the museum or reading the novel or the catalog of the novel with that. But there, I think, there is. If you ask me to find similarities of sentiment of writing of both novels, it's another thing. That I wrote this novel, looking at, for example, pictures of Abdul Hamid, what is known as Abdul Hamid albums of photography albums. Abdul Hamid, the Ottoman ruler that my novel is busy about, was also cared about photography. He paid a lot of money, bought photographers, and put these photographs and probably looked at them very interested because he was not also leaving his palace, Yıldız Palace. He was also a bit paranoid, but he wanted to see his empire and enjoy that. His desire to photograph, his joy of photography, I think, did not come to represent his successes, all the hospitals he did, all the time towers or saat kuleleri he invented, clock towers, but more just to look at them because he was not traveling, he was not leaving. But anyway, I wrote this novel, for example, going to Istanbul University Library and turning the pages of these things, just like I wrote Museum of Innocence, looking at objects of daily life of 1970s, 80s. Some of them I got from my mother, from my friends, from my family. That is, objects, pictures, things had the power to motivate our imagination. Maybe I'll be more modest. My imagination. And that's a method of writing for me. And once I discovered this, in fact, I self-consciously thought about building a museum and writing a novel and doing this simultaneously. It is not that one day I wrote a novel which was very successful, so I thought, why don't I make a museum of it? No, I actually wrote a story which talk about the relationship between human imagination and objects or postcards or photos. They all motivate us, me, and also they are the sources of history. They are called documents or And that's how I also worked in that sense when I wrote this novel, looking at objects, things, etc.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Abdul Hamid, and obviously this is a good cue for me because our seminar is about Abdul Hamid. My lectures this year were about Abdul Hamid. And obviously, Abdul Hamid is a very difficult subject to treat. And you've done it in a very oblique way because Abdul Hamid is not present in your novel. He is in the background. He is a reference in the discourse of some people. He is a little bit like we imagine him, lost and walled in his palace of Yildiz, cut from the real world, some kind of a reference, which obviously leads to a very easy way of idealizing things about him, either as the Red Sultan, the butcher of Armenia, or on the contrary, as the greatest Sultan, the last great Sultan, as the present government has it. But it's very difficult. I mean, I think it would be a real challenge to try to bring Abdul Hamid into the story as a character, give him agency, because he's too big to handle in that sense. And even what you say, I have to disagree on the photograph albums. I think the photograph albums are a collection of photographs that formed because obviously a palace is interested in images. But I am not convinced that Abdul Hamid was spending his days in his palace, leaving through these images of the wider world or of his own achievements like hospitals, bridges, tunnels, and whatever. I think it was something that he macro managed as a way of promoting his image and of communicating, especially when he sent them to America and to these albums to America and to Britain. But I think we have a tendency to exaggerate the agency and the capacity of this man to really do, control, participate in everything we associate with his reign.
Okay, now. Okay. The three subjects are embedded in your question. The absence of Abdul Hamid. True that there's a lot of talk of Abdul Hamid in my novel as a person who, as an autocrat, everyone is afraid of him. And also my narrative voice also filling the gap, saying that Abdul Hamid's mind was busy with building hospitals, modernity. He was not interested in modern ideas, but he was interested in modern science, medicine, developments in hospitals, so forth and so on. The fact that he is absent is really related because he was rarely leaving his palace. He was only going out to mosque on Friday, which was not very far away, and you wouldn't see in the streets. As I saw Charles de Gaulle in 1964 in Taksim Square in Istanbul, you wouldn't be seeing Abdul Hamid. You can only put him in a plot, in a story, if someone marries the family, or if he sees, just like Pierre is seen by Napoleon or one character. So we have very little presence of Abdul Hamid, I mean, visual presence of Abdul Hamid because of that. Now the second subject you opened is, we have Abdul Hamid is a very controversial figure in Turkish history. He is an important figure. It is hard to pin him down, or the nation, Turks, or let's say historians, representative of the cultural, ideological, literary trends, are still arguing about Abdul Hamid. We can compare him, and he also compared himself with her, Queen Victoria. His imitation of 25th anniversary of his
jubilee
was so a direct imitation of Queen Victoria's jubilee. Abdul Hamid was the most important Ottoman sultan in the last 150 years, I think, after Sultan Mahmud II. And he had carried a lot of contradictory, or what we think of as contradictory motivations, that he was interested in factories, hospitals, engineering, westernization, deep westernization as far as science and invention goes. He was, in that sense, very modern. While on the other hand, he closed the parliament, did not believe that no one, he wanted to be an autocrat, and he was. He was, I think, pictured as a ruthless killer. I think he was, that was a bit exaggerated, but yes, he did so horrible things to Armenians, he did horrible things to many people, but he was not very much, for example, did not go around and subscribe to the idea of capital sentence, tried to avoid it, while in Turkey today, politicians are trying to get votes saying, capital sentence, and people are saying, yes, yes, yes, we want it. Abdul Hamid, while on the other hand, wanted to avoid it. So Abdul Hamid is like a Turkish Queen Victoria, not because he was very clever, inventive, this or that, because he was in power, how many years? 33 years. And that defined that, that the later sultans only were more puppets in the hands of bureaucracy, army, while Abdul Hamid fought back, managed to control exiling, threatening, terrorizing the bureaucracy. He had seen before he was enthroned, he had seen two sultans, just one of them killed, just get rid of by the bureaucracy. So he was, of course, right to be paranoid about that they will do the same thing to him if he don't listen to them. So he began to torture, change their situation of all the pashas that did the same things to the previous sultans. So he is fascinating. He is a fascinating figure. His absence is also fascinating because the people of that time are related to him only by gossip, hearsay, and nothing negative could have been written about him at the time. So he is a major figure in Ottoman, last 100 years of Ottoman history. I wouldn't praise him. I wouldn't say he was a great sultan. And in fact, if I were a historian, I would do my best to show his influence less, but historical, other institutions more important. But on the other hand, I'm a novelist. Of course, it is interesting to write about the fact that he cared about detective stories. He invited Conan Doyle, the writer of Sherlock Holmes, invited to him to Istanbul. Gave him a medal, but just before he gave the medal himself, he heard that Conan Doyle wanted to also know about, visit Yıldız Saray, where he lived, and he immediately get paranoid, or this is the rumor, and did not want him to come and enter the palace. Perhaps some people advised him that if he does so, sir, the next Sherlock Holmes novel will be set in Yıldız Palace. He was worried about that. But on the other hand, he was not a typical Islamist in the sense, while he also, because of political situation, he wanted to say to the British that, hey, if you take my empire away, I will also uprise the Muslims. I am their caliph. I have this power. Though he was, if you compare him to the regular Islamist today, yes, he was a bit conservative. He was praying and going to mosque, but he enjoyed opera. He built a little theater in Yıldız Palace to enjoy opera, enjoyed detective novels, cared about Western science. And it's
Sarah
not
Bernard.
A
Sarah Bernard. For
it's not a typical. His cultural tastes and private choices are not the private choices and cultural taste of a regular Islamist. But political life forced him to invent political Islam, in a way.
I agree. Although I've spent most of the month of January saying terrible things about Abdul Hamid, but I recognize that in terms of modernity, the practicalities of modernity, he was part and parcel of a very, very active engagement in that direction. I'm not sure another sultan wouldn't have done it. I mean, I don't
done
think
what?
He need. I think any sultan in the 1880s, 1890s would have engaged in modernity because it was the only thing you could do. So I do recognize he has some kind of wise appraisal of a balancing act in diplomacy. I called him the strategist of the greatest strategist of weakness. He uses a weak situation in a very strategic way to survive in a world that is extremely threatening.
So yes. But let me say something about this. But I okay, I understand. Abdul Hamid was, as you said, was a good diplomat, playing into the hands of British Empire and other empires. While, yes, here, as a fiction writer, I don't much care about that.
Sure.
Say, we had in Turkey fiction writers who would only focus on that plot inside another plot and conspiracy inside a conspiracy, what was happening in Abdul Hamid's mind. For me, what was happening in Abdul Hamid's mind was only help me to produce the texture of my book, but not the logic of my book is not interested in Abdul Hamid's mind, but it is. The texture of my book, the imagery of my book, paranoias, stories, sometimes they're very brutal. His interest also in modernizing the prisons, just like in Turkey today, modernizing prisons and hospitals come hand in hand in Abdul Hamid period and today also in Turkey too. I do, in a 600-page novel, you do many, many things. You pick up something that relates to today's Turkey, but you don't. I don't write the novel only for that. A novel is an occasion, and I spent 5 years writing this novel. Express yourself, myself, in so many, it gives your story in the end, gives you many, many opportunities that you want to talk about, that when you venture into that direction and take across many, many distances, then you talk about, I also refer to today's Turkey. I also do what I did in White Castle, immerse myself in a sort of a Gothic atmosphere of play. I also do this of representation, so forth and so on. Yeah. And my novels, in that sense, is a totality of all these sentiments put together in a Tolstoyan way. In the end, in this novel, I most care about getting the history right, as Tolstoy also did in War and Peace.
What are your sources? I mean, you have a historical context. You mentioned Abdul Hamid, and there's quite a literature on him, although much of it is extremely biased and problematic. So I would be curious to see what you've... But also, there is Minguet. There is the plague. There are... it's like a Russian doll situation where you have embedded several stories into one. And of course, what we haven't spoken about, and I'd like to bring it up, is the future of Minguet. The fact that Minguet is the scene of a revolution.
Since Minguet is an imaginary island, there are no sources for it.
Exactly. but then again, as I tried to show, I mean, in your Kamil Pasha, there is something of Simon Bolivar, there is something of Mustafa Kemal, maybe, there is something of Emilio Aguinaldo, there is something that is very universal. And I like the combination of the combination of a very peripheral island of the Aegean, which obviously doesn't exist, and a universal discourse about revolution, nation building, invention of the nation, censorship, history, and whatever. So again, because I insist on the fact that in Turkey it has been read.
But these are different subjects. Why don't I start with what are your sources?
Okay.
Okay, we'll go to that.
What are your sources for each of these aspects of the novel?
One at a time.
Okay. Sure.
Don't ask five questions, but one at a time. I'll give answers to all of them, but one question at a time, sir. What are my sources? I think I am interested in diplomatical history, but one reason that I invented imaginary island of Minger is this, that yes, I for 40 years I've been thinking about writing a novel about plague, perhaps. In my late teenage years, I've read Albert Camus' Plague, and I said, one day I'm going to write a novel like that. At the beginning, it was going to be a novel about metaphysics of death and being afraid of death, which I, at that time, argued by myself that it's also related to being an individual. Later, I was, for almost 20 years, again write a plague novel, but my mind was busy with the discourse of Edward Said, or the discourse that these Muslims, Turks, Orientals are fatalist, kaderci. They don't care about quarantina, and they don't want to know about quarantina. They see death coming from plague as given by the God for their sins. So I wanted to write about that. Another 20 years passed. Then I begin to decide that now I'm grown up, I am a major novelist, why don't I begin writing this novel? And I begin to read about various PhDs, again, the age of which period of history that I should set my novel was not clear to me. Then I discovered about the 1894 plague pandemic, which started in China and went all over the world. While it killed tens of millions of people in Asia, in China, and India, third plague pandemic did not almost kill nobody in Europe. And since I'm interested in East-West things, I decided to set my novel in third plague pandemic. Then I begin to read more about the PhDs, memories, most of them are PhDs, and come across the cholera, quarantine uprisings in Poland and Russia was interesting to me. Also, I might to make the statement that whenever there is a pandemic and a strong government arm twisting the nation so that it stop the pandemic afterwards or simultaneously, it's followed by uprisings. I argue sometimes, maybe cynically, that in the end, Black Lives Matter uprisings will be written by future historians, not only related to horrible state of blacks in the United States, but it will be also related will be written as by historians as uprisings related to the pandemic and imposition of quarantine. But anyway, once I decided to set my novel in late 19th century, early 20th century. Then I begin to, I stop reading. I set it in an imaginary island. I also decided to set it on a small island in eastern Mediterranean because I like these places. Because I needed a small place, I needed an isolated place, just like in my novel, Snow. It snows so much in that novel. People are isolated from rest of the country and civilization. And this is a literary invention developed mostly by from Thomas More to Daniel Defoe, Robinson Crusoe. Isolation makes history move faster. Thus, history is more visible in isolated small places. That's why I needed an island. That's an epidemic in an island, which is also surrounded by military boats, that they are just like in Snow by themselves. I did not want to argue with critics or readers. Well, one of the major examples, as you have said, is Crete. But I didn't want to write a history of Crete. I wanted to write a general history representative of invention of nations based on religion or language, we'll discuss later. Then I begin to read, now that I didn't care about getting the diplomatical story right, because I have an imaginary place. But on the other hand, I cared very much about getting the daily life objects, what they ate, how was telegraph, which sort of telegraph they used, photography, this or that. I am proud to say that one of the main sources was, there is this big supermarket in the United States, in Chicago, Sears it's called. I found their catalog of 1897, in which there are tens of thousands of pages of objects. At that time, they all supermarkets, also Harrods in England. I also find their, 1897 catalog of Harrods, which is 1,500 pages each page. In every single object they sold, at that time, there was someone called catalog painters. They were not photographed. They were painted minutely in black and white line paintings by these catalog painters. I loved looking at these catalogs. They, motivated my imagination. If I had seen, let's say, a photography machine or a meat mincing machine in that catalog, I also thought my characters in my novel can use that. When I was writing My Name is Red, I used a tereke defterleri.
Inventories after death.
Inventories after death, or nakh defterleri, the municipality's pricing lists, and made it sure to myself that don't ever use any object, anything, any food, any service that's not counted in these lists. Again, my characters always used whatever inheritance and thinking that more or less a similar object would be that, so that I will not make historical mistakes like making my characters listen to radio when there is no radio was not invented. I avoided. So these catalogs of supermarkets, I'm sure Bon Marché also had a catalog like that, but I couldn't find it, or I'm not very good in French. But this is one important source for my novel. And since I was more busy with daily life here, but not diplomatics, I'll come to the second source, which is very important for me. In this third plague pandemic, it was very strong in Bombay and Hong Kong, and these were British colonies. And British doctors were sincerely, bravely fighting against plague. But since it was a colonial situation, Indians especially were scared of them. Indians, people were afraid that they were arbitrarily taking up villages, burning sometimes villages, sometimes taking the sick person and sending them to the hospital, and you would never see that person. There were so many rumors, and British doctors in Hong Kong and Bombay was in trouble. Sometimes they were burning places, and sometimes they were taking a whole village hostage. In a way, that's how they saw it. So the center, London, wanted them to write reports about whatever experience. And those doctors, main source for my novel, wrote very frank, very honest, very heartfelt reports of what happened today, sir. And then you can find these things in internet and read those. And I enjoyed writing my novel, reading these reports. More or less, the colonial situation was more grave than, say, in 1901. The difference, cultural authority, political difference between the, quote, locals and the British doctors, where the difference was much bigger than the Ottoman Orthodox doctor and the Muslim Ottoman uneducated person So I also saw my subjects within these doctor's reports. I'm very grateful that I have, I got many of them, and other sources. But of course, there are also sources about Bashma Beinji, the chief chamberlain's memoirs, which he tells about us, how Abdulhamid, I almost copied that those details from chief chamberlain's memoirs, where Abdulhamid not only enjoyed reading the detective, or someone else read to him a detective novel as he fell asleep, and then the reader should be a distinguished person like Chief Chamberlain would tiptoe, and he's not seen. There is a paravan between the ruler of Ottoman Empire and the reader, and he falls, sweetly falls asleep as he follows the Conan Doyle's or Sherlock Holmes' latest story. So diplomatical, I've read memoirs of Ottoman pashas who were just marginalized after the Ottoman Empire, and they wrote their memoirs. All of them, most of them, were published in newspapers. Rarely they have been put into books. Or Abdulhamid's daughter's memoir, My Father, Abdulhamid, which actually, coincidentally, my uncle published in Hayat Mejmuas, a magazine, Hayat, which is a sort of an imitation of Life. Then it was put into a book. But, you know, in my childhood, they would talk about these things because that was a success. Sales of Hayat went up because of that, so forth and so on. But mainly, I did not care about reading diplomatical history. I got that, you know, even reading François Jourjon's book on Abdulhamid, or two or three more books was enough for that. And I was not aiming getting the diplomatical history right. I was aiming getting the atmosphere, the details and objects and feelings and rumors right.
Thank you. I didn't realize you had finished. I was waiting for more because...
Okay, also, I'll give you more.
No, because they are fascinating, and I know how much you like, for example, Ziya Shakir,
who is
fantastic author who has done something that historians should have...
Another subject, of course, we talk about that. You know, we're friends. We not only see each other in Collège de France, we also meet in Istanbul and talk. And as I wrote my novel, Edhem helped me a lot. And one of the things that I discovered also, checking with them, Edhem, do you trust this book? I care about and like popular history. I refer to my uncle, the publisher of Hayat. He also published Hayat Tarih Mecmuası, and bought personally the first issue to me. Popular history, as you know, is history told in a fascinating way, and sometimes a lot of exaggeration and romanticism, and a lot of also stories, not fiction, is also involved. But anyway, my sense of history is deeply intertwined with fiction. But because I like popular history books, popular historical fiction, I like them. But on the other hand, I don't say that, fiction and history are more or less the same. Ziya Shakir, you know, is a popular historian who had a sort of a long reportage or interview with a retired concubine of Murat V's harem, and that person is told directly all the details of Murat V's, Abdulhamid's elder brother, who was dethroned because he lost his wits, perhaps. And then a Turkish popular historian wrote this, not as a quote, what we today call as oral history, self-consciously, but put it in a fictional shape. Once in a while in the book, he's saying, these are all told to me by a retired concubine. But it has such a realistic power that official Turkish historian İsmail Hakkı Uzunçarşılı uses this fictional book as a source, as a scientific source in his history book. So I use these the memoirs to enrich my book. But in the end, yes, my mind was busy with more, with the atmosphere of plague, the overabundance of people dying around, and the rhetoric of invention of a new nation because of the falling, the decline of the empire. My book is all about that.
If I may, on the issue of popular history, I think there's a very interesting break in somewhere around the 1950s and 1960s. That is, the first wave of popular history in Turkey was extremely interesting because it was not politically motivated, and it was mostly based on the recollections of a generation that had lived through, say, the end of the 19th century. After the 1950s, there's a combination of two things. One, that generation kind of dwindles away. And second, more importantly, the past becomes a political matter. In the 1950s, and especially with, in the case of Abdülhamid, with the publication of Necip Fazıl Kısakürek's terrible, terrible book about Abdülhamid, the great sultan, which is, you know, a eulogy of, and this is the beginning of a tendency which I think still dominates popular history in Turkey. Popular history is basically political popular history or political ways of doing history without footnotes.
It is political, but yeah, I also...
It wasn't. In the times of Ziya Shakir, that's what makes... Ziya Shakir, in a sense, is an oral historian who didn't have the academic formation of doing that. So that's, I think, extremely precious, and I'm pretty sure that you haven't used Necip Fazıl to draw a portrait of Abdülhamid, but rather the earlier sources.
Or the same time with Necip Fazıl. Okay, maybe we should explain. Necip Fazıl is a sort of a cult hero for the ruling party, for Erdoğan. They are. He was also victimized by the secular establishment, put into jail various times. He was also a demonic figure. Very typical in his early youth, he was a pro-Western, imitated is a strong negative word, influenced by Baudelaire and wrote poetry of wine or demonic poetry in his early years. Merdivenler, kaldırımlar. Pavements is everyone knows about it. Is a great Turkish poem. Then, late in his later years, somehow he turned inward. He was anti-establishment. He was anti-secular, and developed many stories, books. They don't necessarily be based on reality, but a rhetoric of anti-Westernism and anti-secularism. And because he was, because of these books, put into jail many times, he is a sort of a hero of the AKP ruling party now. In fact, in my novel Snow, there are twin-like young Islamists, one of them called Necip, the other one is called Fazıl. These were my ironical jokes. Very few of my readers, even in Turkey, got it. But now I enjoy it also because of Necip Fazıl's importance. Yılmaz Öztuna, a young, brilliant, but very nationalist to the level of racist, yes, a Turkish historian, also did very a full book on Abdülhamid, which is more accurate and less seems to be less ideological than more seriously historical than Necip Fazıl's book, which is more just rhetoric. But he has the power, Necip Fazıl, on the other hand. He has the rhetorical powers to move you. And it is easy to address Turkish readership with motivations, with anti-Westernism, these Western powers always making some conspiracy in Turkey. We had an empire and now we have lost the empire. This is an attractive subject. And then In that sense, yes, popular history. And Necip Fazıl wrote a popular history book, a portrait of Abdülhamid, who was a victim of super imperialist Western powers, so forth and so on, I will say. Okay.
As we are nearing the end, there are two topics I want to bring up. One is East-West. You said that it was a major thing. And the other is nationalism, because it is one of the leitmotifs behind the Knights of the Plague. So East-West, and you said that initially you moved by the desire to counter the Orientalist notion that fatalism in Oriental, and especially in Islam, was the cause for the propagation of the plague, and you wanted to. But then again, I don't think you are completely in sync with anti-Orientalism, in the sense that we are in a time when Said's Orientalism, which is an intellectual quest for the to understand the origins of Orientalism, has been turned, especially in Turkey, into some kind of a very basic third worldist political discourse.
I met Edward, and he was, and I always wanted to say it, but I didn't say it because I respected him so much that Edward. By the way, there is a harem, and it's not invented by Americans, you know.
Okay.
That is the major criticism of his book. Yeah, but about that, he is writing and criticizing all the romanticism and ideological romanticism. These are subhumans and so forth and so on. And yes, he was true. He was right about that. There was almost racism, this, or all the horrible things that went into description of harem, saying that these people are so horrible and the harem is a horrible place. But it existed. It was not invented by Europeans who could not even enter them and did imaginary paintings of harem like Melling, because they couldn't see it. So they did imaginary paintings. But on the other hand, there was a harem, and women were put into a harem. Yes, they exaggerated that in West. They made a discourse that also suppressed the Muslims or local peoples or the colonials. But in the end, there was a harem. My take on Orientalism or East-West is this. But it is an attractive point in my life, in my fiction, because I live in Istanbul, I live in a house, I was born in Asia, spent my life in Europe. Turkish politics, culture is defined by that, because there is in the nation, in the hearts of everyone, I would say, a desire, or most of the nation, a desire to be a part of Europe. And there is also, if you're a novelist, you know this, you may entertain two strong conflicting arguments in your heart all the time and carry them around. Once you're a pro-Western, at the same day, you are a very nationalist and hate Christians. And I have met so many people. It's not human mind is not I believe in A equals A and there's no B in my mind. You know, Shakespeare and Dostoevsky had discovered that. We carry in our minds, in our hearts, strong conflicting ideas, and that's what makes us. That what is how we are, and that's what I learned from fiction. And also, a lot of people that I have met in my life carry these anti-Western sentiments, and also I would say like Dostoevsky or like Japanese writer that I care so much about, Tanizaki, has the same. And I also share this sentiment of, and understand this sentiment of love and hate relationship with Europe and West. Right?
Love and hate works for everything.
Yes.
As long as you don't reduce it to only love and hate. I mean, that's the very complexity of something that you are living through. It's just normal. But I think you were asked once, why do you hate the West?
Yes. Right?
By a journalist who just picked love and hate.
Yes,
which doesn't make sense.
Your second question was nationalism. Maybe I'll say a few things about
nationalism, because I mean, it is, I think, one of the most important, and what I find to be fascinating in your take on nationalism in this book is that you're talking about a region that is identified by some of the strongest nationalist tendencies, nationalism combined with religion. I mean, look at Turkey, because despite every claim to secularism, even in Kemalist times, Turkish nationalism is in fact, deep down, Muslim nationalism, somewhat tamed. And if you look at the Greek side, it's practically a mirror image of that. And therefore, when you are faced with an island, which, call it Crete, call it Minger, call it whatever you want, is squeezed between these two great nation nationalisms, which are potentially racist and potentially sectarian, it's fascinating to see this little island to managing a kind of decent form of nationalism that is not defined only through religion, race, and whatever. That is a little bit... So I wonder if there is some kind of a utopia of a proper nationalism that might have been... think of islands, again, think of Cyprus.
So let me give the answer.
Okay.
We are, in fact, venturing into... I'm a professor at Columbia University. Columbia University, sociology, first year. What is nation based on? Is it religion? Is it language? Is it shared history? Is it shared geography? Or is it something else? More or less, you're saying, Orhan, in your book, I see it's language. I think it's more religion, you're saying. I disagree, but do we want to discuss this? You ask me about nationalism. Now I want to approach the subject in autobiography.
I didn't say it was religion.
Okay, I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
But on the other hand, I also want to clarify that nationalism in my novel doesn't make Minger a peaceful, happy place. They put people who do not follow the official nationalist history into prison camps and torture them and treat them bad. But on the other hand, nationalism, if you open the subject, is interested in, because my take on the subject is through Mina Mingerli, perhaps using him as a way of distancing myself from the subject. And in a way, as I said it right at the beginning, that my mind is busy with professors' political correctness. I am a person who is, I'm using political correctness. I am not negative. I don't have any negative idea about political correctness. I want to be a political correct person. Since it's a negative word, I would say I want to be a right and moral person and represent other people right and do an intellectual and spend an intellectual effort to get them right. And political it is belittled as political correctness. It's a good thing. And I have so many friends at Columbia University who want to be politically correct, and if you're a nationalist, you're not politically correct. But is it possible to be my Mina Mingerli, portrait of Mina Mingerli is that, is it possible to wanting to be politically correct and wanting to be not to be a nationalist is one thing, and really not being a nationalist is another thing. If you are busy with the history of a nation in so many years, if you care about the little details that you found in the archives and cherish them, write about them, and romanticize them, or treat them as objective documents chronicling the life of these people, is it possible not to care about these people, not to love about these people? Is it possible not to develop sentiments putting these people in a different pedestal than the rest of humanity?
Does it have to be nationalism?
Nationalism as, okay, now that is patriotism, you may say.
Yeah.
Nationalism as a political movement, I hate it. It leads to racism. What all the things that Adolf and people similar to him had done. But on the other hand, as a cultural subject, it is hard to avoid. As a sentiment, it's hard to avoid. That's what I'm saying. And that is the ironical way, perhaps, there is something of Mina Mingelli in me too. And when I make fun of Mina Mingelli, I am also putting in brackets my situation or every Barnes's situation. Once you're busy with the culture and history, or once you're writing stories about a nation, a group, a language, I'm embedded in Turkish. I am not saying I'm a nationalist, but I care about Turkish things. I am in it. I represent them knowingly or not. I am a part of that huge culture. Trying to avoid being nationalist in politics. I want to be, if you want to see me, I consider myself a leftist liberal or something like that, which is not, I don't care much about that definition. So that's my take on nationalism.
Okay. I just meant that Mingerian nationalism, despite all its defects, seemed a little more acceptable than the kind of big nationalism that we see in that region. So I was wondering, in a sense, if it was your way of trying to tone down what you've experienced.
Maybe I was saying that it's... okay, maybe I was not making Mingerian nationalism acceptable, but... as the empires disintegrated and dissolved and ended, the idea that the emperor, the padishah, the kaiser, the king, who is, we believe, to be the shadow of God, is disappearing, then God also is disappearing from our vision of the world. Then people go to war, believing that they are dying for padishah, king, sultan, kaiser. He is so holy, and he is worth dying for, because he is the shadow of God in this world. But once he disappears, how do you motivate people to go to war? Then you have to invent a secular that is not godly, but as sacred as God, if this is possible, and that is the nation and the flag, and also the secular mythologies, legends that go into making of the nation. In the end, my novel is all about this, the invention of secular myths, such as my main hero, Kamil, meets his would-be wife in the kitchen. It's dark, and they say one of the 157 Mingerian words to each other, and it just happens in 3 seconds at the beginning. But at the end of the novel, it's a big national myth.
But again,
that's a deliberate thing that I did,
again,
and I liked to, in a way, deconstruct or show the making of national myths, national secular myths, and what you find understandable, that I am tolerating nationalism. Yes, but that was inevitable. Once the shadow of God disappears, once the Kaiser, King, Padishah disappears, in order to motivate the people and lend them a give a meaningful life so that they will go to war and kill each other in a heartfelt, very heroic way, then you have to invent new secular myths. My novel is also partly about the invention of secular myths. And perhaps that's why people get upset. And I was invited by the public prosecutor, "Sir, are you insulting Kemal Atatürk?" And my answer, "Which page, sir?"
But I think, frankly, that Turkish nationalism has been much less secular than you would have it. That's why I find the Mingerian example interesting, because I don't think really that the padishah, the emperor, the sultan, really mattered that way, and that the transition through religion was kind of smooth into the war of liberation, and that the way in which Islam can still be used as a major element of Turkish nationalism proves that the secularization has never gone all the way in
Turkey. We will discuss whether Turkish nationalism is based on religion, other myths, how much it is, I agree with, a major topic of discussion.
Il me reste à vous remercier tous pour votre participation, à remercier Orhan pour cette prestation et à vous dire à bientôt et merci pour tout.